Good evening, and welcome to A Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I am your host, Lance White, also known as The Zany Mystic. Tonight's guest is Stephen Bodayan. Stephen began practicing Zen in 1970 after studying Asian language and culture at Columbia and Stanford. Ordained a Zen priest in 1974, he trained with several Zen masters and directed the training program at the Zen Center of Los Angeles. He also spent 10 years studying Advaita Vedanta with Gene Klein. Stephen is the former editor-in-chief of the magazine Yoga Journal and a contributing editor of Tricycle, the Buddhist Review, and he has written extensively on spiritual themes. His articles have appeared in numerous national magazines, including Fitness, Alternative Medicine, Cooking Light, Tricycle, and, of course, the Yoga Journal. He is the author of the popular guidebook Meditation for Dummies. His other books include Living Yoga, Timeless Visions, Healing Voices, and Buddhism for Dummies. Stephen also contributed this chapter, Deconstructing the Self, The Uses of Inquiry in Non-Dual Psychotherapy, for the anthology The Sacred Mirror. His most recent book is titled Wake Up Now. So let's wake up now by welcoming Stephen to the show. Hi, Stephen. How are you?
Good. How are you doing, man?
Pretty good. I almost lost it there in the middle.
Uh-huh.
But you know what? Humor is a good thing.
That's the zany part of the zany mystic, right?
That's right. you've been a busy little bee here with Zen and the rest. Zen is one of the first things that I kind of was drawn to. I mean, I've kind of tickled my fancy with all of the different spiritual modalities, but I've never really, I haven't pursued them to the point of getting any further than just a very basic knowledge.
Mm.
But I'm just love Zen, and when did you start that path? I mean, as a child, were you? Did you have experiences that led you in a certain direction, or what did?
Well, you could say I had some kind of spiritual experiences when I was young, but they were very fleeting. And then I would say the most influential experience was my mother's death when I was 16, which really. Threw me into a kind of deep inner questioning and exploration. And that's when I started reading about Zen, and it really appealed to me. I remember reading about Zen masters who sat, you know, undisturbed while earthquakes were happening around them. And, of course, I was pretty disturbed at that point, pretty upset.
That was an earthquake you were in.
That was an earthquake, exactly. So that was the beginning, I would say. And I began reading about Zen in high school, and then when I got to college, I read some more. I minored in Asian studies at Columbia, and then after a few unsuccessful psychedelic journeys, I decided to put my butt on the cushion, and that's when it all began.
Yes, those early journeys, I had a few good ones and a couple of bad ones.
There you are, exactly. Exactly. It kind of whets your appetite for something more authentic.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's kind of like they open one door and then the doors don't continue to open up unless you move forward.
That's right. I realized I had to move forward.
Yeah. Who were some of your first teachers? I mean, did you travel to India to find somebody?
I didn't. I was never drawn to India. It was always more toward Zen, which is, of course, based in Japan.
Right.
I studied at the Zen Study Society in New York with a wonderful Zen teacher there named, he was called Taisan at the time, is Eido Shimano Roshi. And then I studied with Shinryo Suzuki Roshi, the author of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind.
Oh, yes, I have that book.
Out in California and the Zen Center, San Francisco Zen Center for a while. And then I went to Tassajara, which is their affiliate, a monastery out in the country near Big Sur. And I was there for a couple of years, actually 15 months. And then, so I had several teachers. Through the years, the Mizumi Roshi, the Zen Center of Los Angeles. So those are my Zen teachers.
Oh.
And then I kind of came to a dead end with Zen. I felt like Zen had, my meditation became dry and lost its life, its vitality.
Yeah.
And my teachers didn't seem to have any real remedy for the situation, and I was experiencing a lot of emotional turmoil, once again, that the meditation didn't seem to help me move through.
Yeah.
So I decided to study Western psychology and explore other paths, and I went back to school and, you know, got a master's in psychology, became a psychotherapist. So I did that aspect of things as well.
Wonderful. Well, it sounds like you have quite a well-rounded view of life.
Yeah, well, that's what I wanted. I felt Zen was, you know, somewhat narrow.
Yeah.
In its view. I think nowadays Zen teachers, a lot of them are trained in psychology, but at the time they weren't, and I felt, you know, I think justifiably that I needed to understand the human mind better, you know, from a broader perspective.
Yeah. If you had to distill the essence of Zen Buddhism, how would you describe that? What would you, you know?
Well, it's actually described for us in words that are ascribed to the founder of Zen, Bodhidharma, which is a special transmission outside the scriptures, no dependence on words and letters, directly pointing to the human heart. See true nature, become Buddha.
Okay.
So basically, Zen traditionally it was intended to be, and sometimes it's be, you know, kind of strayed from that, a very direct approach to truth. The teacher is directly pointing to the truth, offering a student the opportunity through this direct pointing and this transmission to see the truth of their essential nature directly, without, as it says, dependence on words and letters, without dependence on scriptural study, but, you know, through meditation and through connection with the teacher, you would really directly experience your true nature. So that's the essence of Zen.
Now, of course, for a teacher to be a really effective teacher, it seems that the teacher would have to be able to do that himself or to be awake.
That's right. That's the key. And in my experience, my teachers, my early teachers, I didn't feel they were fully awake, or they were somewhat awake, but they had all kinds of issues that hadn't been resolved.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I met my Advaita master, Jean Klein, I finally felt like I'd found a really awake person. You know, when I met him, when I really met him, you know, face to face and had some time with him, I was really stunned. I was struck to my core by the quality of his being. You know, when you meet an awake person, there's something very powerful about it.
Yes, I totally agree with you on that.
I mean, Suzuki Roshi was probably awake too, but I was a very young student back then and you know, really couldn't appreciate him. But, you know, I was ready for Jean Klein.
Huh, nice. Now, with Jean Klein, Advaita is the study of non-duality. Is that? Am I getting?
Yeah. Again, it's a direct approach, a direct pointing, just like Zen is, to the non-dual nature of existence. In other words, subject and object are one.
Mm-hmm.
There is no separate self. Life is living itself through this body-mind, through this manifestation, but there's no separation anywhere. It's all just one flowing, living, vital reality, and that's what you really are, essentially. That's the non-dual experience, or the non-dual view.
Now, would that include the idea that what you do to someone else, you're doing to yourself?
Definitely, yes. So the whole idea of, you know, do unto others as you would have others do unto you, that it kind of gets condensed into, you know, that which you do unto others, you're actually doing unto yourself.
Right. So all of the fragmentation that we see all over the globe, and the animosity and hatred and fighting about this and that and the other thing, all of that is pretty much a distortion of reality then, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's what causes conflict in the world.
Yeah. Have you seen a change? How does consciousness play a role in all of this? I mean, when you mention it's one energy, are you talking about consciousness, spirit?
Consciousness, spirit,
matter, or?
Yes, consciousness, spirit, they're all different words for that one that we are. Yeah. So, you know, you could say consciousness, which is awareness, which is presence, which is life or being itself, is manifesting, is taking all these different forms, you know? Yeah. What we see, what we experience, what we, you know, this body and mind, the bodies and minds of others out there, this is all just the same substance, the same essence, manifesting itself and playing out in various ways, you know? Mm-hmm. But underneath it all, we're all just that, that essence, you know? Call it consciousness, call it spirit, call it being, call it, you know, Buddha nature, whatever you call it.
It seems like all the great masters and avatars have referred to this earthly plane as an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
Can we take that almost literally?
Well, it's real at the relative level, but at the absolute level, ultimately, it's not real. So in that sense, you could say it's an illusion.
Yeah.
So
it's relatively real. At the lowest
level. It's relatively real. Obviously, you know, if you don't put on the brakes, you're going to get into an accident.
Right, right.
That's at that level, it's real.
Right, right.
But ultimately, you could say that it's empty. You know, in Buddhism, you don't talk about illusory, really. Right. You know, from the Buddhist or the Zen tradition, even from the Advaita tradition, it's more like it is consciousness in manifestation. You know. And in that sense, it's a play of consciousness. It doesn't have solid, substantial reality. It's just consciousness. So it's empty of any inherent substance, you know?
People are often looking for some kind of meaning to things. Do any of these teachings that you followed indicate that there's any intent or purpose or driving force behind all of this, other than just to experience?
Well, you know, really every moment is its own meaning. Hmm. You know, in other words, there is no meaning outside of this.
Yeah.
This that we are, this essence that we are, is its own meaning. It, you know, and some of the traditions they call it lila, the play of the divine, right? So this we are living the play of the divine. You know, it's divine play.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
consciousness playing, you know?
Yes.
Does it have any ultimate, you know, meaning outside of this? No, because once you realize what this is, this life, this moment, once you realize the divine sacred nature, you know, of this moment, that you are, you know, so much more than this body mind and you are this being in manifestation. Once you realize that, then that is its own meaning.
Mm.
All the search for meaning is over. there's no need to find meaning outside.
Right. You know? Right.
Yeah.
I know in a lot of the groups that I'm in and when I'm on the internet stuff that I come across a lot of what's the word for it? There's a lot of disturbance about various things that are going on in the world that involve conspiracies, evil, Illuminati, and this and that. Is there such a thing as a dark side to the play we're in that's creating a disturbance?
Well,
is it all just
there is no evil, you know, in the sense of some solid something that we can call evil. Evil is ignorance by and large.
Right, right.
You know, and it's, you know, in the Buddhist tradition they talk about greed, anger, and ignorance. You know, mostly where suffering happens, where conflict happens, where wars happen, comes about because we're attached, we're fixated
right.
on ideas and beliefs about how life should be.
Yes, you know? Yes, yes.
And that's where the conflict happens and the suffering happens, both as individuals and as nations, societies, you know.
Yes.
We see absolutely. It in the world, you know, and, you know, just what's happening in Mumbai, you know, obviously some very strong ideas are at play here and cause people to do violence to one another.
Yeah.
In our own life, when we believe that life should be different from the way it is, and we have strong idea of how other people should behave, and you know, and it doesn't work out that way, then we suffer. You know,
right, right.
So it's when we're fixated. You know, it's okay to have beliefs if we hold them lightly.
Right.
But you know, when we're fixated and we hold on tightly, that's where the suffering happens.
And we create our own suffering.
We create our own suffering.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. Since your book is about awakening, and it has a lot of good exercises in it to take you through the awakening process, I thought it was quite well written myself.
Good, thank you.
Do you notice that people are awakening more at this time since you started studying these very spiritual disciplines?
It's hard for me to say, you know. I mean, who am I to make that judgment? I have no idea.
Yeah.
I just know the people that I know. I don't know.
Yeah.
I have no idea. I mean, it's a nice idea. You know, speaking of ideas,
yeah.
It's a nice idea that more and more people are waking up now. It's a pleasant idea. It's a appealing idea.
Yeah.
But, I mean, who knows? I don't know.
Well, it seems that there would be many benefits to people awakening.
Absolutely. That's what's important. The important thing is not are more people waking up. The important thing is, how about you?
Yeah.
You know, what about your life right now? You know, are you interested in finding out who you really are? And, and that's what's the only, that's really the only important thing.
Oh.
For each one of us.
Uh-huh. In your book, do you talk about how to recognize when you're having that spiritual awakening that can come in so many different ways?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I do in the book, is to help people distinguish spiritual experiences, for example, from awakening. Now, you know, spiritual experiences, you can have experiences of beings from another plane. You can have, you know, flashing lights. You can have kundalini energy going up through your spine. You can have, you know, feelings of unconditional love that flood through your body. I mean, these are all spiritual experiences. And they can be, you know, very wonderful and very pleasant and bring certain insights.
Right.
But the difference is, and again, not to downplay those, they have their virtue, but spiritual awakening is a fundamental shift in identity. It's a fundamental shift from taking yourself to be just this limited story, this limited body-mind, separate self that you've taken yourself to be for your whole life, made up of, you know, the beliefs and the thoughts and the feelings and the memories and all of that. That's who we take ourselves to be.
Mm.
When we wake up out of that and realize that we are being itself. We are essence, consciousness, awareness, whatever we call it, spirit itself. And this is vast, it's limitless, it's all-pervasive, and it's vital, it's vibrant, it's living through us at every moment. It's what's looking out through these eyes, it's what's experiencing life through this body and mind.
Mm-hmm.
That's what spiritual awakening is. It's awakening out of the dream of being a separate somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You don't stop being that too, but you awaken out of that and realize that you're so much more than that. You know, you encompass everything, ultimately. Everything is included in you.
And what are some of the ways to, I mean, do people actually experience that sensation? I mean, I know I've had moments during those experiences years ago where I felt as if I was one with everything.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Well, it could be. Feeling you're one with everything. The question is, do you go back to just, you know, you can have that experience. The question is, who's experiencing that?
Yeah.
Really, see, that's the deeper.
Yeah.
Because you can have experiences of being one with everything. If you come out of that knowing that you indeed are one with everything, and that there is all, just one, there is just this one.
Yeah.
If you come to realize that and realize that that's what you are, that would be spiritual awakening.
Okay.
But if you come out of it just realizing, wow, I just had this really great experience. I just experienced
right.
I had the experience of hanging on with everything. That was cool.
Yeah.
Now let's have dinner. You know.
You're back to being a little tiny fragment.
That's right. So it's a question of, you know, does it really change? Does it really transform
right.
your identity, your locus of identity? Do you really transform your knowing of who you are. And it doesn't have to have a whole lot of bells and whistles, you know. People think spiritual awakening's got a, blaring trumpets and flashing lights and, the whole panoply of experiences that, people identify with.
Right,
enlightenment,
right.
If you saw the movie The Little Buddha, where he sits there and all the dancing girls come by and all the hordes of Mara try to attack him, we think of enlightenment like that.
Yeah.
But it can actually be very simple and direct. It's really a recognition of what has always been the case anyway. I mean, you've always been, essence, consciousness, spirit, whatever we call it. That's always been who you are. It's not like something changes. It's just that you recognize what has always been the case. And that recognition is very powerful.
Hmm. Well, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And seeking comes to an end because you're no longer looking for anything more. There's a sense of completion, of sufficiency. I've found what I was looking for. The spiritual journey, at least that part of the seeking part of the spiritual journey is over.
Right.
I mean, there's
right.
more to come, usually. But there's no more seeking. Seeking comes to an end.
Yeah, that does make a lot of sense. And then it seems that there are many little enlightenments that can occur along the way that kind of act like spikes in the road.
Mm-hmm.
Does synchronicity play a role in all of this?
Well, in one sense, there's only synchronicity.
Right.
In other words, there's always what's happening is always synchronicity. Everything's just arising moment to moment out of the void. That's what's happening.
We're just not recognizing.
We're just not recognizing that.
Right.
Yeah.
And of course, things like television and American Idol and football games and work and various other things do distract us, although they are the arising of life.
That's right. That's right. There's nothing wrong with them.
Right.
But they can be misleading.
Yes.
They can, seduce
us. Don't they call those traps, spiritual traps?
Yeah, they can hypnotize us, right?
Hypnotize, yes.
Yeah, they can hypnotize us into...
And then we fall asleep, and then we believe in the dream. And
that's right. And you got it. You got it. We believe in the dream. We believe in the drama. So we go to TV, and we go to sports or whatever to continue the drama.
The drama.
We have our own drama, and then we have all these other dramas.
Yeah.
We just get enthralled by the drama.
Yeah.
And again, I like football as much as anyone, but
it's non-attached football.
I'm sorry?
You can watch football by being non-attached to
it. That's right. Yeah. Watch a good game. It's a beautiful thing.
Yes.
But
Yeah. And not be concerned about who wins, huh?
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Maybe. Just watch it for the beauty of it, like you would watch anything.
All right.
A beautiful musical performance or dance or something.
And of course, just like the football game, we're as much in a play as they are.
Exactly.
I wonder who the spectators are.
That's right. We are, who you really are is the spectator. Hmm. Who you really are is the one who is experiencing this life from moment to moment. The one who can't be named, who can't be touched, who can't be located. This ultimate experiencer is who you are. We say, I think, I feel, I taste, I touch.
Right.
But who and what is this I that we're referring to? It's not the brain.
No.
It's not the body-mind. The body-mind doesn't experience, It's just a thing, It's an object in awareness. Who is this I that is aware? That's the question.
That's a darn good one.
Yeah, and that's the question that question can lead you to awakening. That's one of the things
many
I talk about
in
my
book.
Many years
ago, I started to read Gurdjieff and Uspensky, and I enjoyed the idea that Gurdjieff presented that we are many eyes, that we're not just one eye, but, we have these different brains, instinctive, moving, and so on and so forth, and each one has its own group of eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And so that made a lot of sense to me that, we're not just one eye that is continuous and doesn't change. We are congregations of eyes that change with the wind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But You mentioned Kundalini experiences as part of the awakening process. Have you ever had one? Or
yeah, I have.
You have? What was that like?
Well, again, I don't consider that particularly important.
Oh.
Kundalini is just sort of like a byproduct.
Mm-hmm.
And for some people, it seems like Kundalini can bring about awakening, but not necessarily. So it's not something that, you know, I encourage people to cultivate. If
right.
it happens to you, you have no choice, really. But I don't... when I had my most powerful awakening experience, it was accompanied by Kundalini, you know, some pretty powerful Kundalini energy. But it was, the Kundalini wasn't the point. It was the recognition. It was the insight. And with the insight, it's like all my chakras opened up and all the energy started pouring out of my head. But it was more the insight, the recognition, again, the awakening, which opened everything up. So it was in a way the opposite. Kundalini didn't bring about awakening. It was more like the awakening, I think, opened up the Kundalini.
Right, right. Yeah. Was this during a particular meditation or?
No, I was driving in my car.
Okay.
It was actually the words of my teacher came back to me, John Klein. The words were, the seeker is the thought. The looker is what he or she is looking for. And he had said that a number of times, and I was just driving in my car, and those words came into my mind, and suddenly my world turned inside out.
Wow.
There was a recognition of what those words really meant, you know. So words from a teacher, an enlightened, awakened teacher,
mm-hmm.
can be very powerful. And that's what I meant by the direct approach, the direct transmission. When the student is ready, certain words can be very powerful
mm-hmm.
In awakening.
Don't they also, doesn't a good teacher also plant seeds for the future?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, those words are seeds. You see?
Right.
You hear those words, and when you first hear them, they don't make much sense, you know? But they kind of go deep inside, and they kind of get, you know, because I wasn't even thinking of those words. The words just came into my mind. You know, they just appeared. And in that moment, there was this turnaround in consciousness, and there was a recognition. So, you know, yeah, they're like seeds, and then suddenly the seeds will blossom. In my book, I say it's kind of like a virus in your computer hard drive.
Uh-huh.
You know, the teacher plants a little virus in your hard drive that will eventually eat up your hard drive.
Yes. Then you have to reboot.
And then that's right, exactly. Then you have to reboot. That's great.
Or, like myself, you lose your hard drive.
That's right. Now, that was, yeah, definitely.
I lost mine.
Yeah, you lose your hard drive. That's great.
That's right.
Great.
So, it can be quite a lesson.
Yeah, right. Buy a Mac.
Does ego have a role to play along the way, and how important is it to... There's so many different schools of thought about ego and what it is, and it's... use and its role, its function, that so many people say you have to eliminate ego, and many people say that, you know, ego is there to be cultivated and used as a tool.
Yeah, it's a very good question. Yeah, that's a very good question. It depends on what you mean by ego. You see, the word ego, which means I,
mm-hmm.
you know, capital I, you know, in Latin, has many meanings. You know, it was used... most commonly by the Freudians, you know, ego, id, and superego, right?
That's right. That's
so
right.
From the Freudian, the psychological point of view, ego is a mechanism, a psychological mechanism that mediates, that kind of bridges the gap between the drives of the id, you know, the needs of you know, to eat and sleep and have sexual relationships and all that, with the outside world. So the ego is the way of negotiating in the outside world and getting our needs met. That's, from that point of view, ego is essential. You couldn't live without ego,
right.
you know.
Right.
But then ego, the word ego is also used to translate the Sanskrit word atman, and in like anatman, and it was used to talk about the self-image, the self-concept.
Mm-hmm.
For from that point of view, we awaken out of ego, you know. We awaken out of the self-image, identifying with the self-image, and we realize who we really are, you see. So in that sense, you could say that ego is like an illusion. It's just a construct.
Mm-hmm, right.
It doesn't have any real substance to it, you know.
Even though it does seem that seem pretty real to us or to others.
Right. But then there's also the ego, which is like self, you know, the me-ness. You know, we identify with this me. That's ego, you know.
In
common parlance, that's probably what we mean most by ego, being ego-centered, you know, ego-driven, and egomaniac.
Selfish.
Selfish. So very self-centered, ego, this me.
This seems to be a particularly selfish generation.
That's what we're told, you know, the me generation, the baby boom.
Yeah.
And maybe we're waking up, you know, historically now we have no choice now because of this economic situation. So ego is, it also includes conditioning, a lot of conditioned responses to life.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, ego can kind of keep seducing us back into this self-centered view of life, right?
Right.
So in that sense, it can be very tenacious.
Yeah. It seems like it's also the part of us that feels that we are right and somebody else
That's
is wrong.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
The one that has to defend its point of view.
You got it. Yeah. That I'm the center of the universe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Even though, in a sense, we are, and we're not.
Yeah, right. Well, the I that's the center of the universe is not the ego.
Right. Are there as many ways to arrive at a spiritual way of life as there are people to find them?
Probably. Yeah, there are many different ways to awaken. You know, awakening can take many different forms. Fundamentally, it's the same. What you awaken to is the same. But, you know, different people's awakening experiences take different forms. You know, as I said, it's fundamentally that knowing, that recognition of who you really are.
Yeah.
Beyond the mind, beyond the ego, beyond the self-image, beyond the dream, that's the recognition. Something that can't be grasped, it's the mystery.
Yeah.
We call it all these words, you know, consciousness, etc. But it's a mystery. It can't be grasped, but it can be known directly, not through the mind,
right,
but through a direct apperception, a direct recognition. So, you know, that is fundamentally what it is. But for each person, it can have a slightly different flavor, you know. Mm. The experience itself can be different. It's kind of like a jewel, you know. You awaken to a jewel, and when you first see the jewel, you may just see one facet of the jewel.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and the other person sees another facet of the jewel. And then eventually you begin to see the whole jewel of your true nature. So, but you know, it's ultimately your awakening. There's only one thing to awaken to.
Well, with the direct perception, wouldn't that imply that intermediaries would not be required?
That's right.
Such as priests and complicated esoteric rituals and religions and smoke and mirrors and all of that.
Smoke and mirrors. That's why I call it the direct approach, you know.
Yeah.
What we're offering, what I'm offering in my teaching work through the book, Wake Up Now, is a direct pointing without intermediaries. You don't need a whole lot of practice. You don't need years and years of practice. I did it, but it's not necessary.
Right.
And what really seems to be helpful is a teacher, either through books or a direct relationship with a teacher, which I recommend because I had that and it was good. You know, I really appreciated it. And then, you know, just to stay with those teachings and let them really work on you. It's nice to sit quietly and just be open to what is. It's nice to inquire. I have a lot of exercises in the book, a lot of guided meditations that people can do. But you don't necessarily need to follow some lengthy practice over years and years and years.
Right. I like that about your book.
Yeah.
You know, having been through an esoteric school in the 70s, I thought I was finding a teacher. And I discovered that you have to have more discernment in choosing a teacher. It's not like going to a grocery store.
Right.
So it can be a sticky wicket when you get into a cult and you find out that it's taken a turn in the wrong direction.
Absolutely.
And of course, then you find out it's from the teacher, well, this is the only way, and if you leave, you're dead.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
Yeah.
There were quite a few cults in the 70s, 60s and 70s.
And I think there are still some.
I would suspect there are.
So I think it's good to, when you meet a teacher, to really check the teacher out.
Yes.
One of the things my teacher, Jean Klein, used to say is, when you meet a true teacher, you will feel more free rather than less free.
Oh, yeah.
And you'll feel that the teacher doesn't need you to be his student or her student.
Yeah.
There's no grasping on you as a student.
Yeah.
You can feel that with certain teachers, and you feel like they're pulling on you, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
When you read a real teacher, they free you to be you.
Yes.
And that's a true teacher.
That makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. You also have a school, don't you?
Yes. I have an eight-month school, which now this is the second year we've been doing it. We'll do it again next year. Yeah, it begins in June and goes through the following February, and it is, again, the school for awakening. It's, in a certain way, it's a kind of a joke, because you can't go to school to awaken.
Right.
So I like it because it's kind of humorous in a way.
Yeah, I like it too.
To call it the school for awakening, but at the same time, it is kind of like a school. We spend three-day weekends together in the course of the 8 months, spaced out, you know, like 3 or 4 months between them. And then we have phone sessions, which are an hour and a half long, and we meditate together. I lead guided meditations, and then I give a teaching, and then we have time for dialogue, and then we do that like a dozen times throughout the 8 months, and then each person has the opportunity to have a total of 6 hours, 12 one-half hours or 6 hours or any combination thereof with me on the phone, in what you might call spiritual counseling or spiritual mentoring.
Uh-huh.
So that's the way we work. And the intensives are really quite powerful, and people come from all over the country.
Wow.
It enables people who live in places where these things aren't really available to come and be with a small group, it's 12 people.
Oh.
So it's a small, very intimate group.
Where is that located?
Well, it's up until recently, it's been in Austin, Texas.
Oh.
I've been doing the intensives in Austin, where I've been living for the last 2 years, but I'm in the process of moving back to the San Francisco Bay Area, where I've lived for many years.
Oh, wonderful. Yes,
and
I've lived there, too.
I'm sorry, you lived there, too?
I have in the past. I'm in Northern California now.
Where are you?
The Placerville Gold Country.
Oh, yeah, nice. I like that area.
Far enough away from San Francisco to be, outside the vibes.
Exactly. It's nice out there. It's a little more rural, more country, slower pace of life.
Yeah.
So I'm moving back to the Bay Area, and so the next school we will probably be, we may have the intensives in several different places, just to make it easier for people. I'm still deciding how to do that.
Well, that sounds very good.
Yeah, and it's on my website, which is www.stephanbodian, StephanBodian.org, and the school and the counseling that I offer. I do spiritual counseling for people throughout the world. I've had clients from China, India, Great Britain, France. So people call me for spiritual counseling, mentoring.
Wow, wonderful.
So on my website.
Wonderful. You mentioned the development of integrity and that it was important to develop integrity. Could you speak about that a little bit? Why is it so valuable to the awakening process?
Well, integrity, the way I understand it, integrity comes from integra, which means one, So integrity means really to come into alignment with yourself. That's my understanding of integrity. When we're in integrity, we're in alignment with the truth of our being,
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, the ultimate integrity, you could say, is awakening.
Right.
When we realize who we are.
Right.
But it can really help to, at a relative level, to live from integrity, live from truth. there was not be deceiving yourself, not be deceiving others, to do what really feels right, you know, from an intuitive and a heart level, you know, rather than coming from ego, you know. That's what integrity means.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that there's a natural desire, as one awakens, to want to be less, to be more inclined to service to others?
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
It's, it does seem that way, and I know when I did the S training many years ago in San Francisco, they talked about that quite a bit, that, you know, lying was a was one of the ways that we undermine our own integrity, and that without that, and without being able to keep our word, that our word loses its power.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they just had a different way of explaining it.
Right.
But I do agree that it's extremely important to be truthful, especially
That's
with
right.
yourself.
Yeah, if we're devoted to truth and we want to find out the truth of our being, but we're living a lie,
right?
Then what's the point? I mean,
right.
We're talking about truth at every level.
Right. You're chasing your tail then.
Chasing your tail. And, of course, you know, sometimes we are deceiving ourselves in ways that we don't readily recognize.
Right.
But as much as we possibly can, you know, to be, try to be really clear and clear in our communications and clear-sighted in our, you know, appraisal of ourselves and how we express ourselves.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. A lot of the New Age thought focuses around the idea that we, our thoughts and emotions create our reality. How does that resonate with your training and background and knowledge and wisdom?
Well, first of all, you know, the law of attraction, as it's called, you know, and the secret and that whole school of thought, you know, again, I think it works to a certain degree, first of all, at the relative level.
Yeah.
If you do focus your intention on certain things happening, then it's, you know, it's possible that that focused intention will help make that possible. Make that thing actually happen.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the time, not all of the time.
Right, right.
You know, and so the problem with that approach is that, number one, if you don't succeed, then you end up feeling bad about yourself.
Right.
And you feel guilty because that's the law of attraction. If you haven't succeeded, then you must be doing something wrong.
Right.
It's also very me-centered. You know?
Right, right.
It's like, what do I really want? And let me put all my energy in to get what I really want.
Yes, yes.
And the secret, you know, I'm sure I'm going to step on people's toes here, but, you know, it's, you know, these people with their fancy cars and their fancy houses. And you know, and it's like, oh, gee, you too can manifest this.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And if you don't, you must not be thinking the right thoughts.
Right.
You know? It's like, give me a break, will you?
I agree.
It's like, really? I mean, come on. This is not, I mean, there's no way that this can be true.
Right.
You know, I think it's kind of a baby boomer myth, you know, that's, you know, the me generation. Sure,
yeah.
You think it and you'll have it, you know? How, you know, and if you're not having it, then you must not be thinking it enough.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it's...
Well,
it's credible. It's not credible.
No, and it's the wrong... It's a distorted thought form that material things should be more valuable.
That's right.
That you are what you have.
That's right.
And
that's
so
right.
If you believe that, then you always are going to feel that there's something that you're missing because you don't have that Rolls Royce or that second
house.
Right. Or,
whereas what I'm more interested in is learning to really enjoy and, you know, take delight in what you already have.
Yes.
In who you already are.
Yeah.
To find fulfillment in each moment. You know, there's a great Zen saying, every day is a good day. You know, every moment is sufficient unto itself. You know, it's fulfilling. Every moment is fulfilling. You don't need, you know, because you create what they call in Buddhism hungry ghosts. You know, with the big mouths and the narrow throats that can't swallow anything.
Yeah.
You know, more, 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 more. You know.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, at the same time, you know, if you really want something and you want to think about it, then I'm sure that's going to, you know, it could help. It could align your energies to get certain things done, you know, really focus on it. Like when I wrote the book, you know, I set aside time every, you know, certain, you know, 3 days a week when I would really focus on the book. And, you know, I just put a lot of energy and time into that. And, of course, that really helped the book get done. So at that level, of course, yeah, I mean, that definitely helps. But that's different from the law of attraction.
Yes, absolutely. There's a zany saying related to what you said. Not every day can be a Doris day.
Not every day can be a what?
A Doris day.
What's a Doris day? Oh, Doris day.
So it, just like every day, you know, you can also have a day that's not a Doris day.
Uh-huh.
I had to throw that one in.
It's okay. It dates us, my friend.
Now, you mentioned light. There's so many, everybody's talking about light and light workers and light this and light that. And and that everything is light, that there's nothing that isn't light, and so on and so forth. How can you help us understand what the nature of light is?
I would say everything is light, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. But that's just another name for consciousness.
Okay.
Another name for spirit. Yeah, it's light, you know. You know, but it's light or it's spirit or whatever we call it, you know, it's essence, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, yeah, it is all light, yes.
I used to have a mentor who said, your mind is out to get you. How does the mind, the constant thoughts of one's mind, thwart one's ability to connect with what's more authentic within oneself?
Yeah, of course, that's a good question. I mean, in a certain way, that is the question, right?
Yes.
You know, it's not so much, you know, how do we awaken, is how do we keep unawakening ourselves?
Right.
You know, because in a sense, you know, what we're talking about here, essence, light, whatever we call it, that is our natural state.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this open, unfurnished awareness, this spacious, welcoming presence is who we are.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
How do we keep seducing ourselves away from it?
Mm-hmm.
First through childhood conditioning, which wasn't something we did, but then that conditioning keeps reasserting itself, right?
Mm, absolutely.
Through the identification of ourselves as this separate someone, and oh my gosh, I've got this life story, and this is really bad, and oh my gosh, if this happens, then this is what's going to happen, and we're in the future, and we're anticipating all the bad things that are going to happen, and, you know, worrying about the future, or we're obsessing about the past and all the things that happened a long time ago. And
right.
That, you know, and we spend all this time in the future or in the past.
Yeah.
And we don't appreciate the beauty of the moment.
Yeah.
That's how the mind, you know, the mind keeps seducing us into the past and future.
We're almost insane, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. We are. There's no question. We're insane, yeah.
It's just, there's really no other word for it.
Yeah, we've lost touch, you know, with our essential nature, which is as obvious as the nose on our face, and yet we keep missing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the mind keeps hiding it from us. You know, it's hidden in plain sight. As they say in Advaita, the open secret, you know. Mm-hmm. It's always available, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Who is looking out through these eyes? What is experiencing this moment right now? What is that? You know, there's an alive, awake presence that is encompassing and experiencing this moment right now. It can't be touched, it can't be grasped, but it's can be known. It's our natural state. It's always available. It's always right there. You know, it's our nearest. And yet we keep missing it. You know, there's a famous story about this Sufi fool Nasruddin, you know, who used to go back and forth across the border with these donkeys, back and forth, back and forth. And the border guards could never figure out, you know, they knew he was smuggling something, but they never could figure it out. He gave up his work and he moved somewhere far away. And then one day he ran into, in this faraway city, he ran into one of the border guards and said, you know, I always wondered what it was you were smuggling. We never could figure out. And Nasruddin looked at him and said, donkeys. Yeah. So it's like, It's what we're smuggling in plain sight. It's actually the donkeys. You know, the donkeys were carrying these baskets of stuff back and forth, and they couldn't figure out it was actually the donkeys. We missed the obvious.
Yeah.
So what is experiencing this moment right now? It's so obvious, and yet we think we disregard it because it doesn't seem important to us. So that's what awakening is. That's why people laugh when they wake up.
Yeah.
Like, this is what I was looking all over for?
Yeah.
It's so obvious.
Yeah. And then one's view changes, doesn't it? When you see, you look at life from a different perspective. I know I was looking at the, there was some kind of military procession, some important dignitaries were meeting somewhere on the
news. The what?
There was an army with all goose-stepping and, you know, everybody was stiff and formal, and I just couldn't help but laugh at how pompous and arrogant they all were, you know, playing their little games and so on and so forth, and yet that's supposed to be the most important thing on the planet. Very funny.
Yeah. And we're all kind of doing that in our lives, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Feeling so self-important. My little drama is the most important thing in the world.
Yep.
You know, so let's wake up out of that little drama and find out what's really important, because there's no end of suffering. There's no relief from suffering from within the drama. It isn't going to happen. The next relationship, the next job, the next million, you know, whatever it might be that we're thinking is going to relieve our suffering, it ain't going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
We got to turn around and look at the real source of our suffering,
mm-hmm.
which is our sense of being a separate someone, the illusion of being a separate self. To really see through that construct and realize who we really are. That's the only way that suffering comes to an end, you know?
Yeah.
So sooner rather than later, you can start doing that investigation.
Well, it seems that if enough people did turn in that direction, that would be the end of wars and
wouldn't it be lovely, huh?
Yeah, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in order to do that, I think people should pick up your book, Wake Up Now, and start working on it immediately.
Well, thanks so much, yeah. It's, the title is A Guide to the Journey of Spiritual Awakening, and it does kind of take you from beginning to the end, through awakening to the very integration of awakening in everyday life. Yeah,
it's a beautiful book, and it has it's just very, very well written with and easy to follow, and not at all you know, I didn't feel like it was over my head or that I had to, you know, scratch my brain. It was just very gentle powerful at the same time. So we're almost out of time. Would you mention your website again so people can look you up
and
check your website out and find your book and so on.
Yeah, it's again, the book is Wake Up Now, A Guide to the Journey of Spiritual Awakening. It's published by McGraw-Hill. And the website is www.stephanbodian.org. And again, it has information on the School for Awakening, my books, which include Meditation for Dummies as well.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And then also the counseling and teaching work that I do.
Absolutely wonderful. Well, thank you very much, Stephen, for being on the show tonight.
My pleasure, Lance. It's been great to talk to you.
Really. Same here.
Yeah, take care.
All right. Good night.
Good night now.